Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Mac, and you are listening to Mac's Musings. Tonight, my guest is Vernon Wells. I'm sure that most of you know who he is. He really doesn't need any introduction, but I have to introduce my guests so that you know who they are. So I am going to be dialing him, and hopefully everything works, and we will be talking to him in just a minute, hopefully. Here we go, and there goes the dialing.
Hello.
Hello, Vernon. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can.
Okay, good. That means we're on the air. How are you doing?
Hello. I'm doing well, thank you. I'm just going to walk out of my office, which has got an air conditioner going and two dogs laying around, and go out into the lounge where it's a little bit quieter.
Okay.
Okay, I'm out here in the lounge now looking at the ocean, much nicer.
Okay, good. Now, I know you were born in Australia. I also know that you worked in a quarry at one time, that you were a salesman. And then you got noticed by casting agents, which got you TV commercials, print ads, local TV shows. So tell us a little bit about how that all came about, of how the casting agents noticed you.
You're right in the first thing. It actually goes back further than that. I mean, originally I was a electronics engineer. I'd gone through uni and got my degree in electrical engineering. And I didn't really use it for much. I was working in the telecommunications in large new buildings, helping put in the huge telephone exchanges in buildings for all of the telephone equipment. And it was a little bit boring for me, so I quit that. And then I moved on to working in the country. My family, they had a big contract with delivering, they call it bluestone in Australia, but it's a hard volcanic rock which is crushed, and it's usually put on the top of the roads with the asphalt so that they last a lot longer. And they had a contract crushing that stone, and we had a big crushing facility and trucks to deliver it and everything. I worked there for quite a number of years. And then I went down to the city, down to Melbourne. I was at that stage in the country in a little place called Colbenabbin, which is two horses, a dog, and some guy asleep in a corner. I mean, that was about the majority of the people in the place. But and then I moved back down to Melbourne. And I started working in pop bands, which had been something I'd been doing all my life. But then I got very serious because my mother wrote songs, and she had some of her songs recorded, and she had a very, very good voice, and a gentleman called Slim Dusty, who was an Australian country and western singer, I believe he recorded a couple of her songs, and there was another female artist whose name eludes me at the moment. And so I was sort of following my mother's footsteps. I went into bands, I was working in some big bands and doing my thing. And I got busted up in a bad car accident with the band, in our equipment van. And I fractured, or basically compressed, two vertebrae in my back. So I was kind of laid up for quite a while, couldn't work, do anything. And as I got better and I was able to move around and do things, I became a pain in our manager's butt. And he took my photographs around to all the casting agency, basically pleading with people to take me off him, because he was getting close to burying me somewhere. So this one casting agent, she said, you know what? He's got the perfect look for a series of cigarette commercials that we're casting. And they're shooting three cigarette commercials, and he would be perfect for that. It was for a cigarette company called Braddock, which never ever became a cigarette brand. It was more of a write-off of money for their taxes. You know, they've got X amount of money they got to use in advertising. If they don't, of course, they get taxed on it. So they did all these ads for this brand of cigarettes, which never actually came to pass. So I did that. While I was doing that, she was flogging my picture around to television stations and things. And so I started getting little walk-on things, you know, one line, three words, extras sitting at the bar. A lot of extras sitting at the bar, actually. That was sort of it. I really didn't have any inclination to want to become an actor. It didn't turn me on that much. In fact, it terrified me more than anything. Being in front of the camera scared the living bejesus out of me. And I was sort of very hesitant. I loved being behind the camera. I, in fact, started a company called PUB Productions, which made commercials and directed and worked in that, doing commercials and things, and loved it. And as fate would have it, I got cast into a stage play, which I fought very hard not to do, but eventually I did it, called Hosanna, which was written by Michelle Tremblay, a French-Canadian playwright about Montreal's, the Montreal trying to become a virtual part of France in Canada, an autonomous state of France, basically. And the Canadian government virtually gave them the middle finger and said, not happening. So he wrote this stage play, which was virtually about that. But because he couldn't virtually say, screw the Canadian government, he did it with other ways. And it's a very famous play. It's called Hosanna. I did that, and while I was doing that, I was seen by George Miller's girlfriend at that stage, an actress called Sandy Gore. And she saw a performance I did and rang George and said, you got to come down and see this guy. He's got what it takes, dude, and you really want to see him for Mad Max 2. So basically, not having a clue what Mad Max was, period, or Mad Max 2, I had a meeting with George Miller and drank a couple of cups of coffee, told each other a lot of very bad jokes and carried on like a pair of yahoos. And he left and I went about my business not really knowing what it was all about until my manager rang me and said, you got to go to Sydney and do all the prep work for your role in Mad Max 2, Road Warrior. And I was like, what, who, where, why? And it was just a little bit overwhelming because I had never done a film, I'd never done a production, let alone anything that big. And that was where it started. George had all this faith in me that I could do the role and that it would be wonderful. And fortunately for him, it paid off. And that's where it started. I did Road Warrior, and from there it just sort of kept going for the last 20-odd years, and still working, still doing production, still enjoying it, still having a ball. And I owe it all to a lady called Sandy Gore and a gentleman called George Miller that had faith in me.
Well, they knew what they were talking about because you were basically the big draw to the movie. I mean, yeah, I know Mel Gibson brought people to it, but your character stood out because I was in my 20s when that came out. And, well, actually, we didn't see it here, most of us, until later in the 80s, because if you remember in the 80s, it took a while for movies to come onto the VHS. Yeah, so it was a few years later, but I remember seeing that. And, of course, being in my 20s, I liked Bad Boys. So I really loved your character more than Mel Gibson's. And I know a lot of other girls felt the same way. So, but I'm glad you had a good time doing that.
Oh, I loved it. And
I'm
you
sorry.
know what? Mel was the kindest, most giving person. To somebody who'd never done a major film or a major role, he was so genuine and so genuinely helpful and just a real easy human being to work with. And I just, you know, loved him for it, because that could have gone one of two ways. It could have gone the way it went, or it could have gone really bad because I was just scared witless of what I was doing. But
aww,
having him back me up, and George and all the rest of the cast and everybody, it made it so easy and such a great role to do. And there was so much prep done for George. He's big on prep, you know. He makes you come up with a reason for everything that your character does in the script. You don't get to go on set and just start playing. You get to work really hard at working that character before you even get in front of the camera. And I think that's why his films are so successful, because by the time you step in front of that camera, you are the character. I mean, you know every nuance of that character because you have written it out. You have come up with them. You have decided on what that character is with his guidance and with Terry Hayes, who was and Brian Hanna, who were the other two writers. We came up with every nuance to that character so that when you started filming, you were. I was Wes. That was Wes playing. That wasn't Vernon Wells. That was Wes on that screen. And I think that was what made it work so well. Every other character was the same. You know, they were all the character. Even Mel, as his character, he was that character. So I think that was the genius and the beauty of George Miller directing and doing those films. And I'll be forever grateful for the fact that I was able to work with him in my first major production of my life, and to have such an amazing time that it actually tainted me for the rest of my career. It's like when you start at the top with the best, you know, you're suddenly like, oh, this is what the film industry really like. Ew. But I liked it better when I was working with George, you know. It was that kind of thing, because you kind of came to a hard reality eventually of going, oh, not always that way. You don't always get a week of writing a character analysis and things, you know. Most of the time you get 6 hours and you're put in front of a camera and you better know what you're doing, dude. So, yeah.
Yeah.
But I'll always be thankful to Mel and to George and to Sandy and to all the actors and everything in that show for being so easy to work with and giving so much that it made me understand what I was, who I was, and made me love the business I'm in. So, you know, that's basically what got me here.
Well, good. I'm glad that you had such a great experience for your first feature, your major feature.
Oh, yeah.
That's always a good thing instead of having a bad experience, obviously.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
After that, I'm sorry, were you gonna? There's a little bit of a lag, so sometimes I don't realize the person's talking. Were
oh,
you going
right.
to say something else?
No. I was waiting for you.
Okay, sorry about that. Now, in I think it was 1985, you did like 3 movies, something like that. You did Weird Science, which was a pretty big movie, and you did Fortress.
Mm-hmm.
But you did one with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and I'm sure you get asked about that a lot. But since it is a big movie and he's a big star, I'm going to ask you about Commando, just what it was like working on that and working with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
It was actually interesting because I was over here doing Weird Science. I was doing Inner Space. It might have been Weird Science I was doing for Joel Silver. And while I was here, Joel told me he was doing a new film called Commando, and he would love me to come see the director, because he thought I'd make the perfect villain. And so that was really how it came about. And I went and saw the director, and he said no, he was going to pass on that because he didn't see a Wes-type character in that role, which sort of threw me for a loop because I kept thinking, hang on, what? You think I'm going to play Wes in it? And, of course, I had nowhere to go because, if you remember, in Weird Science, I was playing Wes again. So I was kind of trapped between the devil and the deep blue sea on that one. But it didn't worry me because I was quite happy to go back to Australia, which I did. I left and went home and did Fortress, as you asked me about. After I'd finished Fortress, I had a phone call from America, and it was Joel Silver's office saying that they had a ticket for me at the Melbourne airport, and I had like 48 hours or 24 hours to get my life into gear and get on the plane and get back to America because I was doing Commando. And I was like, what the hell? And so I did my thing and I flew back to America and went in and they cut my hair short, shaved my beard off, put me in a costume that really didn't fit because it wasn't mine. Took it out where they could, did all the things I had to do to make it so I could wear it. And then I was on set. And I really had no idea why I was there doing it because I knew they'd been filming. And somewhere along the line, something had happened and they had decided to part ways with whoever was cast in that role. I have no idea who it was or anything about it. All I know is that I got asked to come in and do it. And it was actually an interesting meeting with Arnold Schwarzenegger because the next morning I was on set and I had no idea who Arnold Schwarzenegger was, by the way. Couldn't even pronounce his name. So I was on set, I was very tired, having flown over the day before from Australia for 12 hours. I was, still a little bit under the weather with time lapse of time, different time zones. And we were doing the scene. The first scene I shot was the one where he's tied to the table and I have the knife at his throat. And I say, you know, if I'd had my way, I would have cut your throat. so we are setting up for that. And I was a little tired, but I also work differently. I like to see where the camera is, where the lights are, where everything is. It's the director in me, I think. And I like to know where I'm positioned so I can not be blocking people's lights and I can get into a good position to be on camera. And so right. I was really not doing the rehearsals with a full vigorous, you know, like, burr. I was doing them more with a tepid little meow. And Arnold was a little bit concerned, apparently. He suggested to Joel Silver that maybe this wasn't going to work out. And Joel said, you know, let's just do the scene. And if, you know, if you're not happy with it, then we'll shut things down and recast. And, of course, the minute the director said action, I just went into the character and I had that knife in his throat and I did that whole scene glaring, you know, like in his face. And when it was over, Joel apparently walked over to Arnold and said, so what do you want to do? Do we shut down or can we keep moving? And apparently, I don't know if this is real, but apparently what I was told was that Arnold looked at Joel and said, never give him a real knife. And that was the end of it. So wow. It was over. Then we became great friends and great mates and, you know, got along like a house on fire. It was a little bit of a non-conspicuous type of introduction, but after that it was fine. And I enjoyed the film. I had a ball on that film. We both got hurt in it. I had my elbow fractured and Arnold had his, I believe his shoulder either tore a muscle or got a crack in his shoulder. We were like too big. You got to remember Arnold and I are very similar sizes. You know, I'm not smaller than he is. So, you know, we're kind of the same build, right. Big boys. And we just right. sort of went at it like big boys, you know, it was who could pee up the wall the highest. You know, there was no sort of, well, just, you know, throw little love taps. It was like we were out there swinging, man. You know, when I was beating him to death with the door off that burner in the basement thing where I was hitting him with the door from the furnace. We were going for it. I mean, we really were. And when he slammed me into the electrical the panel, you know, I got hurled across the room. But the point was, it was real because that's where we both were in that scene, you know. It was like one of us was going to die and the other one was going to live. And you couldn't sort of do it as a little pity-patty, nice boy thing. It had to be guts and glory. And it was. And I think I have to give a lot of respect to Arnold for being willing to come up to the challenge with me and just go for it, you know. So, yeah. I had a lot of fun doing that. A lot of fun.
And it came out good because those scenes between the two of you were, well, kind of scary because you got these two big guys. It's like, hey, wait a minute. There's a very good chance that Arnold might not win.
Yeah, that was that was the point of what they wanted. And, you know, I think
exactly. That
was why I got brought back into it because they wanted someone that looked like he could beat Arnold. And then it's that same Rocky thing, you know, the hero's down, but the hero throws a punch and slowly gets up and slowly becomes the hero and wins. And,
right.
I mean, with someone my size, of course, he had to be good enough to do it, which was, I think, what they wanted. And, you know, I enjoyed it. I had fun. It was, again, like Road Warrior. The crew was great. The actors I was working with were great. Director was okay. It was just, you know, one of those real fun things, and I got along well with Arnie. And, you know, if I see him now, he always says hello. Same with Mel. If I see Mel, he'll say hello, which I think is great. You know, it just, you can still respect each other, whether you did, you know, this thing or not. It was all done in respect to making a good movie.
Oh, that all sounds really good to me that you had such a good experience. Now, next one I was going to ask you about. I only picked this because I like the name of it. It was a short called Dickwad, and you played a character called the Biker for Al. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was fun. That was actually very cute. It was a very good friend of mine, Jeff Salentano, who was an actor, a very good actor. I was actually best man at his wedding. We were very close at that stage in our lives way back. And we'd worked in South Africa in a couple of films. That's where we met and became very good friends. And he wanted to become a director, so he wanted to do this little short that he wrote called Dickwad, which was a very cute idea about a guy who got on the wrong plane and he thought he was going to San Francisco. I can't think of the name of the place over the bay, but it's similar to Auckland. And he got on a plane going to Auckland with New Zealand. And the thing is about this guy wanting to get back to America, having gone somewhere he has no idea about, and one of the people he runs into is me, and I'm this big, you know, biker with a mohawk and, you know, totally out of control, and I turn out to be a nice guy, actually. I'm just full of crap. And it was just fun. It was just a very fun, cute little film, and it got him directing. I mean, he's been directing for probably 15 years since that particular little short was made. And it was well done and a lot of fun, and I enjoyed my little part in it. And it, I've done another film since with Jeff, and I like what he does. He directs quite a few action movies. He's a very good action director. And so, you know, I had fun doing it. Just one of those things out of the box that occasionally you do, you know, people say, hey, can you do this? I have one at the moment called Fear of the Woods, which is a 20-minute short, which is actually the first 20 minutes of a feature film. But they decided to shoot 20 minutes of it and put it in the circuit and see how much, how much they could generate in people wanting to see it and get an audience behind it, of which they have done. It's won something like 12 or 13 awards. worldwide at the moment. So it's going extremely well. And later, when we can get into a point of where COVID's a little more controlled in the world, I can fly back to Sweden, and we'll do the film, which will be a really cool movie to do. But I've done a couple of really cool little films, and I've done a lot of really cool big films. I must admit that now I tend to get all the greatest roles offered to me. And a lot of them, of course, have been put on hold simply because of the COVID-19. But slowly the business is coming out from under that, and people are doing films by the guidelines because they want to get back into making films. So I'm starting to get back into doing things, but it's all, especially with me, I sort of say to people, if you don't follow the guidelines, you don't got me, and I'm not going to work, because my life's more precious to me than one film. So, you know, let's make sure we do all the right things. And everybody is. Everybody's so upfront about making sure that everything's followed and that everybody is safe and secure. So, I'm happy that all those people are getting back into work, because, you know, they need to be. You know, the film business, you're a freelancer. You know, very few film industry people are on a contract that if something like this happens, you keep getting paid. You know, they're like paid when they work. You're not working? Sorry, dude, you're not paid. So, you know, it's nice to see that we can get something starting to slowly come back online, and they can be making a living again.
Right. Yeah. Well, near the turn of the century, you started in a very popular franchise, and I'm sure you know what I'm driving at here, the Power Rangers, and you did a lot for that, and you played a character called Rancic. So tell the listeners about that experience, like how it came about and what kind of fun you might have had with it.
My favorite show. I had never seen Power Rangers in my life, that series. I had no idea what it was. And I was actually working in Las Vegas doing I was the host of a nightly show which went around to all of the hotels and things and interviewed all the people in the shows at the hotels, like giving a thing that went out on cable for people in Las Vegas about the shows and what they're about, the people in them and all that kind of thing. And I was enjoying it. I was having fun. It was fun. I got asked to fly back to LA and do an audition for this kids TV show. And I was like, me doing a kids TV show. Okay, that'll be an interesting change. And so I came back to Los Angeles and I walked into the casting office. And it was full of all these people that I knew from television. I mean, all of the best villains you've seen on television in 10 years prior. And I was kind of like, what the heck am I doing in here? I do mostly film, you know, I don't do a lot of TV. So I just sort of waited. My turn came. I went in to do the audition. And sitting at the table was a gentleman called Koichi, who's a Japanese director and also a stunt coordinator. And I had done a film with him 6 months prior in over in Ireland, and it was directed by Stuart Gordon. And I'd done this film with Koichi was the stunt coordinator on it. And, of course, we had got to know each other and talk about things and, you know, and people like him. And lo and behold, he's one of the producers and director on that show. And so he'd asked for me to be brought in. And so I did my audition and I went back to Las Vegas because I figured I didn't have much chance of getting it with all these other people. And I got asked to come back for a second reading. And there was like a third of the people that had been there the first time were still left. So I went in and did the second reading. And then I left and went back to Vegas to do the show. And about a week later, my agents contacted me and said, you've got to fly back to go back for a third because the executive producer had the flu and has not seen you do your audition and he wants to see you. So I said, okay. So I flew back and I went in. There was three people, me and two others. And so I was like, oh, okay. So this is fun. So I went in. I did my audition and did everything they wanted. Left, went back to Vegas. I didn't quite get there. I got to the airport here in Los Angeles to LAX, and there was a message for me at LAX saying, please come back. Tomorrow morning you have to go in for costume and wardrobe and makeup for the series. You're doing it. And so that's how I got it. And I think Koichi had a lot to do with it. And so I became Rancic, the lead villain on the series. And the fun about that is that Rancic, because as you're probably aware, Power Rangers is based on the Japanese version and they use a lot of Japanese footage in it.
Right.
And so the characters are very similar to what's in the Japanese shows. Well, in the series that I did, there was never a Rancic. Rancic didn't exist. He was not the villain. The villain was the girl who played my daughter, Nadira. Nadira was the villain of that series. But they decided over here that they were losing traction with having so many female villains. They wanted to go back to a male villain. And that became me. And so they wrote the character, which was kind of fun. And the girl that was going to be that, she became my daughter, which was kind of fun. And I got to kill the Red Ranger in the first episode, which had never happened in the whole time that that series was on in America. It happens apparently it happens in Japan every other day, they kill a Ranger. But we had never done that. So that was kind of a real cool thing that I managed to kill a Ranger. And I also was the first human villain. All the villains had been some kind of alien or other. I wasn't. I was actually human. So that was kind of another first, which I thought was really cool. But the show itself and the kids, we are all still the best of friends. We see each other on a not a regular basis, but on a semi-regular basis. We do things together. I just, you know, I love every one of them. They're all just the most sweet, sweet people. And I love being around them. And if there's a convention where they have our team there, everybody in the group goes to that convention. The only one that can't make it is usually the girl that played Nadira because she lives in Colorado and she's married and she has a daughter. So she can't always make it. But the rest of us are always there. And after 20-odd years, we're still the best of friends. I mean, it's just amazing and sweet, and I love it. And the funny thing is that Weird Science, the cast of Weird Science that I know, except for the ones that went on to become superstars, but all the rest of the cast, I'm still friends with. If they're in Los Angeles and they're around, they'll ring me up and say, hey, are you the dude? Do you want to have a cup of coffee? And so, you know, Robert Russell, people like that, I get to go have a cup of coffee with them and we carry on like idiots. And I think it's great that you know, so often when you do a film, when the film's over, you always say the same thing. It was great. I loved it. I've got your phone number. I'll be in touch. We got to have lunch, you know, blah, blah. You never do. You know, you never do. You walk out of that set on the last day and that chapter of your life closes. Occasionally, you do a film like Road Warrior, Weird Science, the series, where it doesn't because the people become friends. They become part of who you are. And so you keep in touch. You like to correspond with them and you're happy to talk to them. And I wish it would happen on every film. Unfortunately, it doesn't. But it's nice when it does because, you know, that's what film's all about. We're a big family and we're supposed to you know, enjoy ourselves and stay together when it's over. But I do that with a lot of producers and directors, believe it or not. I work a lot with the same producers and directors, a heck of a lot. You know, I'm convinced that most of them have a problem with reality. They keep hiring me. So, but apart from that, you know, it's all good and fun.
Well, these next two I'm going to lump together, and you can just, like, kind of talk about them whichever way you want. But I like Jekyll and Hyde movies. So I'm lumping them together because, you know, Jekyll and Hyde is basically Jekyll and Hyde, except there may be a slightly different case on it, twist on it, I mean. So in 06, you did The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and then 11 years later, in 2017, you did Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and that one had Mickey Rooney in it.
Yes.
So now I just want you to, like, talk about the two different ones. However you want to put it together doesn't really matter. What those two experiences were like, similarities, differences, and, you know, just different things like that, what the kind of experiences you had on those two.
They actually were very, very good. Both of them. The first one I love because Tony Todd played Jekyll and Hyde, and he played both characters.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it brilliantly. I mean, you know, he went from being the Jekyll to the Hyde, and, you know, and there's one scene when he's in a car, which he's both characters, and he just turns his head sideways. And, you know, they did the makeup on one side of his face. And he just turns his head and he's Hyde, he turns it back and he's Jekyll. And I was just floored by just how amazingly good it was to watch him. And I was working with John, who was a great director and unfortunately has left us. And it was one of those things where one of my good friends was in it, and Steve Wastell, and he played the cop. But my joy of doing that was I had a chimp, and I got to play with that chimp all the time. And I just loved that chimp. And it was because when I first got it, the guy that was the trainer said, "Yeah, you got to be very careful because remember this chimp, even though it's only a year or so old, it has the strength of like six or eight people that can snap your finger or chew your nose off like in an instant. So please be very aware that it is a wild animal." Not once in all the time that I was around that animal and with it did it ever do anything untoward. It would walk along holding my finger while we were doing things. It would jump up onto me and I would hold it and it would go through my hair trying to find lice or something, I guess. And it would mimic me. There's a great scene when I'm playing with a rubber band on my fingers. I'm doing this thing while I'm talking. And in the shot, the chimp is sitting on his cage. And he takes the rubber band off me. And he starts doing exactly the same thing that I was doing while I'm talking.
Aww.
And it's just such a cute moment. Really, and it was not scripted, nothing in the script. This chimp was just watching me while I was doing it, and he just reached over, took the rubber band, and started doing the same thing, and I just continued my dialogue. I love that, and working with Tony Todd was a dream. I mean, he is just amazing to watch. The scenes that we have together are just wonderful, and I just adored every time I got on set with him. Still, we're friends. And I love the fact that John took me, and it was actually the first time I played a good guy. You know, I wasn't the villain. I was the guy who was the friend of Jekyll. And I was the one who saw what was happening to him and the one that tried to rescue him. So it was a whole different thing for me. I wasn't playing the villain, which, believe me, is so much easier than playing the good guy part. You know, you're like, "Oh boy, now I have to do things that are really what I am." So there's a whole different mindset to do that, which is kind of interesting. So that was that one, which I loved with John. Then I did Brian's, which was period. We shot in the most amazing mansion that's all
through the whole place is done in that 20s or, you know, early 1800s period furniture and things. Just beautiful stuff and just wonderful. And we had the costumes and the whole thing, and we shot down the coast in this village. It's actually a shopping center, but it's made like an English 18th century English village, and we shot all the exterior scenes there. So it's all done like it was in the actual story in the book. And I had so much fun playing that, and of course we had Mickey Rooney, and I managed to talk to Mickey once. Not he was on set one day when I was there, and I couldn't talk to him about him because he wasn't interested. He was interested in who I was because he knew everything I'd done. He was like you. So when you did Commando with Schwarzenegger, and I was like, what? No. We don't need to talk about, I want to talk about you. I mean, good God, Mr. Rooney, you've been in this business since God was a small child. I want to know about you, you know, because you've done all these wonderful things. Nope, wanted to talk about me. It was just so incredible. I think it was like a week later he passed away. And yeah. The last time I was on the set, his stepson was on the set with his mother, who was Mickey's ex-wife. And he came up to me while I was on the set, because he used to come on the set with Mickey when Mickey was on the set. He was like his helper. He used to look after him and make sure the people left him alone. He walked up to me and he said, Dad asked me to say something to you. And I said, what? He said, Dad asked me to say something to you before he passed. I said, what? He said, please tell Vernon I loved our talk and that he's to continue doing what he does because he has more talent than so many people will ever get and he cannot waste it. And I was like, I'm sorry, who said that? And he said, aww. And he gave me an autographed picture to give to you. The last autograph he did on this earth was to me. Aww. I mean, that just blew me away. I had Mickey Rooney's, and you knew that he had just signed it because his signature was so bad because he just couldn't write properly. But you know what? I wouldn't have given a shit if he'd have put a thumbprint on it. It is right. From Mickey Rooney, and the last thing he did before he left this earth to go be with God. And I was like, wow, that is just it. Little tiny things like that blow you away. It's like, how do I get to have that from someone of his stature? Why would he be that nice to me? It's kind of mind-blowing that you sort of sit there and think, God, this is just out of sight. You know, it makes you very humble, believe me. You suddenly realize that you are nobody. You know, nobody special. You're nobody better than anybody else. You are fortunate to have a gift and that you should make damn sure that you pay it forward, that you give everybody you work with the benefit of your knowledge. You don't sit in a corner in a chair and be a stuck-up dipshit who doesn't want to help right. anybody because you think you're the end-all and be-all. You get down on your knees and thank your director and producer for hiring you, and you help. And that's what I've got from it, and that's what I do. It's like these people were so humble. I mean, good God, they're just, you know, I've worked with people from that era, and they're just so humble. They're not stuck up, oh, I'm Mickey Rooney. A humble man who was more interested in you than who he was. It just blows me away whenever I work with those people that they're just so kind, generous, and humble, and that's how we all should strive to be. Because they made right. the business what it is for us. We have the responsibility not to screw it up. We have the responsibility to make it better so that the next generation gets to have what we had. Anyway, that's my soapbox. I don't care.
No, I loved hearing all about that. I mean, I'm the one that asked you, so thank you for sharing all of that. That's just a wonderful story.
There was one other older person on that set, the wonderful, wonderful female actress from Mickey's movies that was on the set as his wife. I can't think of her name. Gosh. Oh, what was her name? Anyway, suffice to say, she was very much like Mickey Rooney. She was wonderful, kind, and genuine, and the most beautiful, beautiful lady. Beautiful lady.
Aw. Well, good. I'm glad you had such great experiences with those, and that just was a wonderful story. I was about ready to bust out crying. And I hate to follow it up with this next one, but, you know, what can I do? I got to move on. We've got, like, it's less than 15 minutes. And let me check.
Okay.
It's about 13 minutes, so it's still a little bit of time to go by. The one that I wanted to make sure that we got to was directed, written, and produced by a friend of mine called Jason Buterin, and that's called Kill Giggles. And that's, I think it's in post-production.
It's actually finished.
Go ahead.
It's actually finished.
Okay.
I think the 25th of this month it plays at a big festival. He's already won an award for it, for best film and best, I believe it was best film and best cast or something like that. Or best director. He just, I love him. He's such a way out there on another planet human being that I adore. And that film was just so much fun. He let me play. I mean, my God, he just loved what I did and let me play with it. And I had so much fun. It was a character that I could enjoy because there were so many angles to him. And I mean, how often do you see a film with a drunk clown who can't put his makeup on? And it was just all of this wonderful, wonderful stuff. And I just loved it. I really, really, and the film itself is just amazing. It really is. I mean, I love his catchphrase, "Send in the clowns to die." And it's just, it's just wonderful. And he's so, seriously, I always used to think that I was the weird boy in the group. He makes me look like I'm a kindergarten player. He's wonderful. And his wife and his son, all wonderful people, really, really is. And it was a joy to do that film. It really was.
I'm glad it was a good experience for you. And for those that don't really know, can you give like a short synopsis about it? I know what it's about, but if you could do that for the listeners.
Sure. Basically, the film, it's called Kill Giggles. I play Giggles. And it's about a kid who's traumatized by his parents being killed in a crash, which is caused by a drunk clown on a bike. And they swerve to avoid him, crash into a tree, and they're both killed. He lives, but the last thing he sees is this clown on a bike. He grows up hating clowns. He has a passion for hating clowns. He becomes a mass murderer of clowns. He starts killing clowns. Now, when I come into the picture in all of this is that he's dating my daughter because he wants to get to me, because he knows I am the one who caused the accident that his parents were in. It was an accident. I didn't set out to do anything. It was a pure accident. However, I should not have been on a bike drunk. And so he sets out to kill me using her to get close to me. But I figure it out. And there's a really cool scene in a bar where we're having lunch. And I'm not going to do the dialogue because it gives away too much. But there's this wonderful scene where we're talking to each other, and it's just one of those moments where you go, that is so cool. And you realize, the audience realizes that I know what's going on. And what I do is I set him up so that virtually I'm going to let him kill me so he can get caught, so that he can't harm my daughter, because my biggest fear is that he will harm my daughter. And then my daughter finds out that he's the one that's killing all the clowns and her father. And there's a twist at the end, and I'm not going to say nothing.
Well, obviously you don't want to give away the twist.
No.
Okay.
So it's kind of fun. And it's a really, really well-directed, well-executed, beautifully written film. And, you know, it's starting to reap its rewards. It's playing at different film festivals, be they online, and winning awards, which I think is wonderful. I just think that is so, so wonderful for the cast, crew, and everybody that was involved, because they all put their hearts and souls into it.
Oh, yeah, that's always good to get rewarded, even though it's something simple like, hey, you know, you get best actor or whatever, writer, whatever you get. It's always nice to get some kind of recognition.
Yep.
So we're down to like 8 minutes, and I'm not rushing you or anything. I'd just like to let the people know when we're getting close to the end. Is there any new thing you got coming out that you specifically want to talk about? Some new project, film, painting, sculpture? I just say stuff like that because not everybody has films coming out. They have like books and different things like that. Is there anything that you want to tell us about?
At some stage, there will be a book of poetry that I wrote a long time ago that will be coming out. It's called Ripples. And it's a little dark, but it's kind of haiku poetry that gets a little dark. But it's all things from my life when I was in a very bad place. And I've kept it for quite a number of years, and now I've decided that maybe I'll release it as a book that I can bring it out, and I can use part of the funding from it to help save animals in the world. And that's one of my main things. Is I'm very involved with friends of mine who rescue wolves and wolf dogs, so I'd be putting money into that. And then there's the elephants and you know, dogs here and pets here in America, cats and dogs and things that get very badly abused. I would try to help where I could there. And I think with my notoriety and the fact that I'd be putting out a book of poetry, I may be able to sell a few copies and do something useful for a change.
Well, and especially if you like, you, maybe not tagline per se, but if you let people know that that's the reason is to help animals, because there are a lot of animal lovers, and I'm one of them.
Oh yeah,
and I believe in helping animals as much as you can. I got 2 rescue cats myself. Well, I don't have 2 now because one of them died, but he just died last year. He was like 16, so this one's 17, and I got them when they were kittens, so they've been very well taken care of. But they had both been abused really, really bad before I got them. So I'm all for helping animals. So when you talked about wolves and everything, that's another thing. I love wolves. So you already captured my heart just talking about animals and wolves. And so I just think that's all wonderful.
Yeah, we've got two rescue dogs here. Eddie, who is now 9 years old, who was found on the side of the freeway in a box when he was 3 months old, and traumatized and just thrown away. And when they threw him out, they fractured his jaw, so his jaw's a little weird. But he's a happy little dog who grew up with one of the wolves who passed away unexpectedly about 6 weeks ago. And she was his biggest friend. And he was her pain in her bum, because he would be always telling her what to do was, you know, he weighs 11 pounds and she weighs 98 or something. And he would be standing there looking her in the eye and virtually saying, don't you dare come into this house until I tell you you can. And it was just funny to watch. He was just a little alpha with her, and she loved it. She loved it. She would let him do it. And unfortunately, she passed on, which was a shock to everybody. But so we're involved in that. And the other one we have, we just got her a couple of months ago. She's about 12 years old, and she had cancer, and she had to have a big operation. And they said she had probably 3 months to live, and nobody wanted her. So we said, we'll take her. And now it's 5 months later, and the vet just rang me today and said, I don't know what you're doing, but keep doing it, because she's as healthy as you can get. You know, we just got to cut down her medication a little bit because she doesn't need it. And so that's like, wow. But she does have one problem. She has a heart murmur, and it's at stage 3, which is not good. But there's nothing you can do about that. As he said, just keep doing what you're doing. And when we have to, we'll put her on a stronger heart medicine to control it. But right at the moment, we don't need to, and we're not going to make her, you know, her body suffer to try to have her on something she doesn't need. So she's fine. She trots around. I live on the side of a mountain. She walks up and down the mountain in the morning and the night with me and our other dog. And she has a ball. So, you know, like you, we love what we've got, and we intend to continue doing it the rest of our lives, looking after animals and doing what we can do to help other animals. But on the other side of that, I have about 5 films coming up, which in the next, Kill Giggles being one, Kringle Time being another one, and I've got like 3 or 4 that have just come out. I did a beautiful film called Trouble Is My Business, film noir, black and white, which is out. It's been out for a few months, but it's a really good one. Another one that came out I did in Australia called Landfall, which is a wonderful, wonderful film. And there's, you know, a lot of different stuff, and I'm doing a couple of projects. One being Jack B. Nimble, which is a wonderful script. It's about 4 old curmudgeons in a retirement home who discover a demon in their midst and set out to destroy it. And one of them's in a wheelchair, 3 of them can't walk, and they have nothing except a book of spells from Dungeons and Dragons to defeat the demon. So it's kind of a fun script. Little things like that, which are all happening for me. And I'm just enjoying my life, to be blunt. I'm fortunate enough to be still working, and I'm fortunate enough that people want to hire me, and I thank God for that. And I'm healthy. I'm happy. My wife is wonderful. She's Buddhist, and she keeps me on the straight and narrow, which is very hard. Normally, to keep me on the straight and narrow, you need a bullwhip and a gun, but she seems to be able to do it. And, you know, that's generally my life. I'm just, you know, I'm in a place that I love. Let's put it that way. I've gone through a lot in my lifetime, but I've finally got to that place in my life where I don't have anything to prove. I don't have anything to show. I just have to be me and do what I do and do it to the best of my ability. And that's it. That's me in a nutshell.
Yeah, well, you're a very interesting person. It's been a pleasure having you on the show. There's like only 30 seconds, so if you want to say anything in closing, you can go ahead.
Yeah, quick something. The Buddhist thing is that I just like to say to everybody in your listening audience, from my heart to your heart, please be careful. This too shall pass. We all have to understand that we have to do our part to survive and to help others survive, because that's the whole idea of our humanity, is to help each other. And if we do that, we will get through this. I love everybody. I love you for having me on your show. I wish you all the best, and I hope that everybody remains safe, secure, and gets every dream that they have fulfilled.
Oh, thank you. That's very lovely. Okay, so now the time is over, and they'll probably cut us off if I don't cut this off. So thank you again, Vernon Wells, and I hope to be talking to you again some other time. Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Thank you, sweetheart, and I'd love to talk to you again.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye, love.